So I had four rolls of that net. I put all the sheep, I think it was 180 ewes at the time, put them inside those four rolls. Well, 180 ewes are going to eat up all the vegetation in that four rolls of fence very quickly, like in a half a day. So it meant I had to keep moving them. And so I did, because I decided it was better to lose or wind up having to bottle feed a few lambs that got orphaned in the kind of in the shuffle than it was to just be feeding them to the wolves.
This episode of Voices from the Field continues ATRA's podcast series, She's Raising Sheep. It features Minnesota Shepherd Janet McNally sharing her story with NCAT regenerative grazing specialist Linda Poole. Janet has conquered some of the biggest challenges a shepherd might face: drought, tornadoes, wildfires, Arctic class winters, wolves, parasites, and more. Her tales are in turn harrowing, enlightening, and entertaining, and chock full of information and inspiration for pasture-based graziers. Let's listen.
Hi, I'm Linda Poole, a regenerative grazing specialist with the ATRA program. And with a job title like mine, you have to know that I spend a lot of time thinking about, learning about, and practicing regenerative grazing. This is an exciting topic that has kept range scientists like me hypothesizing and arguing and refining our understanding for decades now. And it's always been a fascinating and important topic, but now more than ever, we need and want to understand how best to manage our livestock for the betterment of our land, for the health of our soils, the water and wildlife, and for our families, businesses, and rural communities. Through careful management of livestock and pasture, we can produce nutrient-dense foods, restore vibrant life to our soils, help mend broken water cycles. There's so much that we can do, but the big question is, how do we go about that exactly? Because regenerative grazing is like juggling six balls all at once. There's the performance of our animals, the health of desirable plants, the biodiversity in our pastures, the health of our soils, the time that we have to put into it, and last but certainly not least, our bank balances. And so today's podcast is my chance to introduce you to Janet McNally, a shepherd and regenerative grazing guru from Hinckley, Minnesota. Janet has a degree in animal science from Iowa State. And in the 80s and 90s, she taught the lamb and wool program at Pine Technical College. For many years now, she's raised pasture-based beef and sheep. And she's developed her own breeds of sheep, the Tamarack and the Tamarack Prolific Sheep. Janet, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, well, let's get started with always what's the big question. How exactly did you get started in regenerative ag?
Well, what I like to tell people is I came in through the back door. I had no intention to be doing what I'm doing at this time. The reason is that at the time, this is in 1999. I've been to some pasture walks and I've been reading about mob stock grazing and some of the practices that we now are embodied by regenerative ag. And, I had concerns as to how I could use this with sheep. All the examples I saw were with cattle, which are big animals, and it's easier, I would say, to trample the mature, very stemmy vegetation that you might get when you use this style of grazing. And I just didn't think this was going to work for sheep because they have a higher plane of nutrition that they need, and they're not as good at trampling coarse vegetation. So I kind of was dismissing it at the time. But in 1999, what happened was is a pack of 23 wolves moved into our neighborhood. And if 23 sounds like a big stretch, you can actually read all about it in a book called The Wolves of Minnesota by Dr. Meach. And he documented that this pack was about 10 miles from us in the fall of 98. And in the spring of 99, I actually heard them howling across the swamp and totally dismissed it. I thought somebody moved in with a bunch of huskies for sled dog racing. That's pretty popular around here. And I did not believe there could be that many wild wolves in one place. It was just a phenomenal sound that I heard, and I forgot about it. I mean, I dismissed it so much that I just never gave it another thought. Well, when lambing began, we were doing practicing at that time, what I call 90s style grazing. And why I call it that is all through the 90s, I went to numerous pasture walks around here in the Midwest, mostly on dairy farms. And the kind of grazing that was practiced or promoted at that time was where you spend about a week in a paddock and you maybe have 4 to 6 paddocks. You move once a week and you come back to your starting point, usually in 3 or 4 weeks, with the goal of keeping everything vegetative. That was what I was doing. It made sense. It's a high plane of nutrition for the sheep. And of course, it did work very well, except for one little problem, which was when you come back into a paddock at 3 to 4 weeks with sheep, you're coming back in when the parasite larvae are hatching at great numbers. Peak larval hatch is about 3 weeks after the sheep pooped on that spot, especially if the temperatures are in the, say, the 80s and if it's humid. So there was, I was using the drench gun a lot. And at the same time, I was trying to develop a strategy so I wouldn't have to be drenching these sheep so often. You know, I was having some shoulder pain and some back issues. And the idea of drenching sheep in the middle of July wasn't a good quality of life issue for me. So I was wanting to get that solved. Well, what happened was, lambing started and I was doing some drift lambing. That's where I move ahead the pregnant ewes are moved ahead every single day. And we leave behind the lambs that are a day old in a paddock by themselves. That gives the mothers time to mother up. Mm-hmm. And then there'd be a third paddock, or I should say at that time, what I did is I kept moving ahead and leaving behind the ones that had lambed so that the goal was at the end of 3 weeks, I would have sheep scattered all over the farm. And I leased land at this time, so I would have sheep scattered all over a 2-mile area because I was leasing neighboring fields. And to give people a little picture here, the fields are fairly small around here. We're cut up with a lot of swamps and woods. So, you know, pasturable land is typically in 20 or 40 acre chunks. It's not very large. Anyway, these wolves arrived and I didn't even know it was wolves yet. I just knew my dogs were starting to act very strangely. Some dogs would leave their sheep and join another dog. These are dogs that always stayed with their sheep. I had dogs that lost their voice overnight. They barked so much that they had no voice the next day. Hmm. I had tied one dog and it actually broke a 500-600 pound test chain.
Wow.
I don't know how we could break that, but it did.
Wow.
You know, just a whole lot of things were going on. I had a dog that left her sheep. I put her in the truck, drove back to where the sheep were, and she stuck her nose up in the air and jumped right back in the truck. And this is all very strange behavior from seasoned dogs that normally were good at their job. This one pasture had a llama in it, and that llama actually lost 50% of the lambs in its pasture. We lost 75 lambs total in a period of 10 days.
Wow.
So it was devastating loss. And lambing was ongoing. I took a hint from the dogs that were leaving their sheep and joining another dog that maybe these dogs need some more backup. Mm-hmm. I had 4 dogs at the time, and I decided to do something that I was always told would be unthinkable during lambing, but I decided I had to put all these sheep together into one mob. And I only had 4 rolls of electrified netting, which does give a little more protection to the animals than strand fencing does. I have prior to this, I've actually witnessed wolves just zipping right through strand fence, electric fencing. You know, when they're airborne, they don't get a shock. And they're so used to barbed wire fences, I think strand fencing just is no deterrent to them. But the electrified netting does help. It's not that they can't jump over it, but they typically try to go through it. And they'll stick their nose into it and get a zap. And I've even heard coyotes yipping because they hit our fence. So I had four rolls of that net. I put all the sheep, I think it was 180 ewes at the time, put them inside those four rolls. Well, 180 ewes are going to eat up all the vegetation in that four rolls of fence very quickly, like in a half a day. So it meant I had to keep moving them. And so I did, because I decided it was better to lose or wind up having to bottle feed a few lambs that got orphaned in the kind of in the shuffle than it was to just be feeding them to the wolves. So I proceeded to move these sheep every twice a day or once a day, whatever it took to make sure they had feed underfoot. Well, little lambs don't move. It's hard to move a group of ewes with newborn lambs very far. And I had land rented all around this 2-mile stretch. So what happened is I kind of inchwormed my way all the way out to the very end of my 2-mile radius, I guess. And by then the lambs were 6 weeks old and were more capable of being herded back to the starting point. Because that's a 2-mile walk. That's a pretty long walk to ask any lamb to do, especially when they're only 1 or 2 weeks old. So by 6 weeks, they can do that. And so I walked them back to the starting point. But my problem was, is that forage was really rank. And as I had formally objected to mob stock grazing, which is essentially what I was doing overnight by accident or forced to, I now had to figure out how to deal with this really coarse rank forage. And I'll admit, it took me a few years. My sheep didn't look too great for a few years. But eventually I was to figure out that what we needed to do, you know, the top of the plant is always growing. Mm-hmm. That's your young vegetative part of the plant. Your top three leaves have the most nutrition in them. And then as the lower leaves on the plant, those are lower in nutrition. And if they're yellow or brown, they're very low in nutrition. So I focused on looking at my pasture and seeing what have they eaten. And when they've bitten off the top third of the plant and they've maybe eaten only half of some of the lower leaves, and it's okay if they bite off the top of the stem, the very tip of the stem, because that's fairly nutritious. But when I saw that they had eaten that, I did not make them stay and eat more. They would. But your nutrition would drop, and then your milk would drop, and then your ewes would drop condition, and your lambs wouldn't be growing so fast. So I learned to really look at my grass and see what are they eating. And then the next challenge came is that if you leave all that stuff standing, then the new growth is only going to come at the top of that plant, and you're actually going to reduce the quantity of forage out in the paddock. So I now had another problem to solve, which was we needed to get rid of this standing forage somehow. Now, a lot of people would run in there with a mower and clean it up, but of course that is gas. And I should explain that only recently do I actually have a tractor. I did not have one at that time. So mowing it meant I had to pay the neighbor to come over and mow it. And, you know, that's cash out of your pocket and so on. So mowing wasn't an easy option for me. So with a lot of trial and error, I figured out just what paddock size was going to work to get the sheep to trample it for me. And as I pointed out earlier, you know, cattle, it's a lot easier to get cattle to trample stuff into the ground. It's a lot harder to get sheep to do it. But, you know, if you get the paddock size tight enough, they will do it. So I wound up with a system where we'd either have for this 180 sheep, it'd be one by one roll. Depends upon how much forage was growing there. And keep in mind, what we've got growing here is way different than what you've got growing out there. We have a lot of volume, although the nutritional quality of what we have growing isn't always as good as what you have out there. But we have a lot of pounds per acre, often 3,000-4,000 pounds to the acre. Mm-hmm. So what would work is we would do a one roll by one roll. This is electrified netting at the 165 feet long.
Yep.
So 165 feet by 165 feet took care of 180 ewes and their lambs on good ground. And then on poorer ground, we might extend that to one roll by two rolls. And that's on some of the rented land where the soils were very poor. Anyway, I did that for a full year. Now we feed hay in the winter, but I mean, I kept these sheep in a mob the whole time for a full year because those wolves were still present all the way up until the following spring. When, by the way, they disappeared, and the word I heard from our DNR was that they think they died from parvo. And it's sort of like they evaporated. And just a side note, that was a pack of 23. I know we've had packs of 18 or so in Minnesota before. My observation is anytime a wolf pack gets really, really large, it usually dies off in a year or so to diseases or whatever. But a pack doesn't stay that large for long.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What I love about your story so far, Janet, is it echoes what I've heard from other regenerative practitioners, is they kind of got backed into it. You know, things weren't working and they needed a better way. But I don't know that I've ever heard anybody who faced as much adversity as you have, you know, all those fangs on the other side, and, you know, after your sheep and after your guardian dogs, and that somehow you had that adversity and then the limitation, I only have four rolls of Electronet. You let that spur you into innovation and a level of success that, you know, really, I don't know that anybody else other than you was doing that at the time. I think it's a marvelous story for us to think about. There's the power of observation and your adaptive management, figuring out the nutrition part of it. It's amazing to me. You also, another piece of it that I think is interesting is how you handle this throughout the whole year, because you're in Minnesota and yeah, you've got 3,000 or 4,000 pounds per acre of nice green, not very powerful compared to Montana grass, but nice green grass for most of the year. But then you get winter. And I know that you have some strategies for grazing outside of those summer months too. What can you tell us about that?
Well, we naturally have some stockpile with the mob stock grazing, because keep in mind, it's getting a 6-week rest. So when we get to the end of our growing season, which is somewhere in October, we still have 6 weeks of grass on hand. So we do graze that all the way up to about December 15th, which is the date where we put the rams in, by the way. Sometimes we have grass beyond that. If it's extra warm in the fall, we may actually have grass until mid-January to graze. But the other issue we have is we do get considerable amount of snow. And I actually participated in a study in 1991 on winter grazing, where we decided to see just how far we could push sheep into grazing in through snow. And the outcome of that is 6 or 8 inches of snow is like almost perfect grazing conditions, because they've got water. We don't have to haul water out to them in freezing weather. And as long as there's an adequate amount of forage under that snow, they have no trouble digging through 6 or 8 inches of snow. And I have to emphasize, there's got to be good quality grass under that snow. And mm-hmm. keep in mind that big growth of rank grass that we dealt with, that happens during June and July. And then when you get through June and July, you start getting this really lush regrowth that's very vegetative coming back. And it never gets quite so rank again in the fall. So it's usually very high quality grass that you have stockpiled. Anyway, we found that we could graze through 6 or 8 inches easily, but it was possible to graze through a foot. And I would say 14 inches was the limit. That's where I felt the sheep were spending too much of the day digging down to get that grass. And how do I know too much? Well, we know that sheep will graze for about 8 hours a day. And I would just check on them and see how much of the time do I see them out there digging, and how much of the time are they laying down? And a couple little guidelines were is they should be laying down by 10 o'clock in the morning if they're getting enough from the pasture. The other thing I did is learn to pay attention to what they've dug up, because if they've dug it up, you can bet they've eaten everything under there. So I would keep track of what part of the field was not dug up yet. And when I say keep track, because if you get a new inch or two of snow, it kind of hides what they already dug up. So I would keep a mental note of what section of a field that they haven't dug up yet. I also should mention that we're not in these one roll by one roll paddocks anymore, mostly because the ground is freezing and it's too hard to move fencing at this point. Mm-hmm. So that last round during November and December, they get the whole field. That could be anything from 7 acres to 20 acres. It just depends upon where we were at. But I would fence in the whole field and not subdivide it, because basically the snow subdivides it. They don't want to go willy-nilly dig anywhere. They will keep working in the, in fact, I even have a photo of these sheep all lined up in a snowbank, working together in a line. It's like they were strip grazing, you know, because they literally were stripping along as they dug into that snowbank. But here's the deal. When you get to 12 to 14 inches of snow, it's okay for a short while. But if that snow is going to stay that deep for a long time, then it's probably time to start feeding hay. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to 6 or 8 inches, there's no time limit on that. You know, they can dig through 6 to 8 inches all day, all, you know, all winter, if that's all you ever got.
NCAT's Soil for Water connects you with farmers, ranchers, and land managers who are discovering practical ways to catch and hold more water in their soils. Find their stories of success, practical tips for soil health, and more at soilforwater.org.
A quick question. Do you think it's that any sheep or cattle could do this, or do you think that you've selected your sheep in a way that they're good at foraging for, you know, doing the stockpile grazing and stuff?
I'll answer it by saying I think a lot of sheep are capable. A lot of commercial sheep are capable of this. I'm not so sure about, say, some of our show lines that have been selected for high corn diets. I'm not going to recommend that type of sheep in this situation, mm-hmm. but a lot of our commercial breeds that are used in commercial settings and used on pasture, I think they're capable of doing this. Cattle, you know, I had Charolais and they were not as good as the sheep at digging through snow, to be honest. They were very quick to be at the gate hollering for some hay. So I felt I could push my sheep a little further than I could the cows, to be honest. The other thing is that the sheep can live on snow all winter long. And I have not watered sheep in the winter since 1991.
Wow.
As long as we had snow, they have not gotten water. I tried that with my cows and that lasted about 3 weeks and I just could see the condition melting off them. So I did go to watering my cows. Now, if you think about it, sheep pull more water out of their manure before they poop it out, whereas cattle simply have a lot wetter manure. So they're losing more water.
Yeah.
I think probably other cattle breeds are more capable than what the type of cattle that I had. And I just simply had bought cattle from the neighbors. So there was no specific reason to arrive at the type of cattle that I had. It was just what was in the neighborhood. And, you know, I was renting from them and it was easy to make deals.
Well, I'm sorry to have derailed you in talking about stockpile feed. And then I know you also do some bale grazing. So could you move into that? How do you transition? You say December 15, you turn in your rams. Is that when you start bale grazing, or how does that work? How do you decide when you go to bale grazing, and how do you do that? And what have you seen in areas where you've been employing these different practices, the summer regenerative grazing, the stockpiled grazing, and the bale grazing?
Sure. So we put the, first of all, I should say, I feed my hay once a year. We don't make hay, we buy our hay. And I usually have to hire a large enough tractor, unload a pretty good sized trailer. So we have the hay come, we have our equipment come, and we have the guys set the hay out into the paddocks that we expect to land in for the winter. So we have paddocks far from home. We graze those into the snow, but I always have the winter paddocks right here closest to the house for a lot of logical reasons, I guess.
Yeah.
A lot of snow. So anyway, we save those for last. We don't graze those early on in the fall. We leave them for last. And we have the equipment come and we set the bales out. And I've learned to tell them to put the bales wherever the grass looks the poorest. If you can see bare ground, put the bale there.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been doing that. We've been scattering these bales about. We make a definite effort to not put a bale on top of where a bale sat the previous year. We want to scatter the nutrients out is what we're trying to do. And so these paddocks will have up to 5 paddocks with bales scattered all around. It looks like we just baled the field up and, you know, they're randomly here and there. Then when we're done with the winter grazing and December 15th arrives, it's time to put the rams in. Actually, I've moved that back, by the way. We've been having these colder springs for several years now. And I've actually moved that back just a few days, but I put them in on December 18th now just to wait for a little more grass growth in the spring before lambing starts. But anyway, so we put the rams in and we put the ewes in the 5 different breeding groups. And this is our most vulnerable time of year from a predator standpoint, is because we've got 5 different breeding groups. And we don't always have enough dogs for every paddock. And it's interesting. It just shows how well the dogs do work, because as soon as you do that, I won't say I have losses every year, but there's always been a problem every 2 or 3 years in the unprotected paddock, is what I should say. So it just shows how well the dogs do work, because our only predator losses at this point occur during breeding.
Mm-hmm. At the time when really they're the least vulnerable in terms of the age of the animals.
Yeah, they're all adult sheep and they theoretically shouldn't be too vulnerable. But, you know, we have quite a variety of predators here. In fact, I even had a fisher kill a 100-pound lamb.
That's amazing.
It's utterly amazing.
Wow.
But anyway, so we graze these bales in the pasture. And I initially did that because I did not own a tractor and I didn't have a way to get these bales out on a daily basis. So it was just simple logic that, well, let's put them all out at once. And, you know, sheep, I got to say, there's big differences between sheep and cattle here. I've tried this with the cattle and I've tried it with horses. And we can do it with cattle. It's just that you have to have a little different strategy than the way I do it with sheep. Cattle and horses tend to go out there and make a personal nest out of each bale. you know, they're big enough, they can tear that bale apart, push it around, whatever. And then they have this nice bed. Whereas the sheep tend to graze one bale at a time as a community, I would say, you know, or, you know, it depends on how many sheep you got out there, but they tend to tackle the bales as a group. And with a foot or two of snow, which, you know, keep in mind by January, where the snow is accumulating here, you get a foot or two of snow, and sometimes we've had up to 3.5 feet, they're not very inclined to walk to the next bale through that deep snow. So they're going to finish that bale right there before they move on. And in really deep snow, I've had to do several things to try to get them to the next bale. When you have 3 feet of snow, they're not going to walk over there. I've done everything from snowshoes, packing it down, to putting a horse in with them. So the horse will break the trail for them. That works. But there are occasions where the snow was so deep, I had to make a trail to get the sheep, and actually had to talk to them and cajole them into moving to the next bale of hay. But that, I would say that's not that common. It's like a couple of years out of the past decade did I ever have to do that. I just want to point out, never hold a bucket of feed when you're wearing snowshoes. The sheep will crowd around you and they're standing on your snowshoes and you cannot use your legs to catch your balance. Not a recommend.
It sounds like a really good video, Janet.
I know, but I tell you, the things you learn over time, right? But anyway, what I found out though was, you know, initially, the first year we tried this, of course, you have these round circles. In fact, if you look at a satellite photo of our farm, you almost always can see these circles. And, you know, it's about 15 feet across and 3 or 4 inches thick. And it depends upon the quality of the hay, by the way. And I'm going to add that grass hay feeds a lot better this way than alfalfa. Alfalfa is a mess. It gets in the wool. The sheep are so selective with alfalfa. They don't want the stems. They just eat the leaves. And they waste a lot of alfalfa. So shockingly, they waste a lot of alfalfa just because they eat the leaves and then leave such a pile of stems. Whereas if you could control the feeding of alfalfa, they'll eat the stems as well. Mm-hmm. With grass, they pretty much eat everything. And I figured there's about 150 pounds of hay left on the ground out of a 800 or 900 pound or eight to a thousand pound bale. Mm-hmm. So two things. One is, what do we do with these piles? You know, we talked about, should we scrape them up? Should we burn them? You know, whatever. And the other issue is, you know, the cost of that waste.
Right.
Is a concern. You know, a lot of people, oh, I wouldn't let them waste that much hay. Well, it was true then, and it's even more true now. When I calculated the amount of fertilizer value in that hay, the phosphorus and the nitrogen and potassium in there, mm-hmm. it actually exceeded that 150 pounds of the hay. It was worth, the fertilizer value was worth more than the 150 pounds of hay that we lost. Mm-hmm. Now, keep in mind, I got to tell you this, is that we are in a hay surplus area. Hay historically is very cheap here. At that time, at the beginning, I was paying $15 for 800 pound round bale. Now, we're not in that situation right now. We've been part of the drought that's affected 65% of the country. And I paid $100 a bale last year for probably 900 pound bales. So we're no longer in that cheap hay situation. And with the fertilizer prices and everything that's developing right now, I suspect we're going to be in this high priced hay situation for a while. If forever, I don't know if it ever will reset back to where we were. So, mm-hmm. But anyway, as far as those piles of hay, and just a little joke, if the neighbors were to ask, we'd tell them, well, there's been sightings. We have these perfectly round circles dotting our pastures.
Crop circles?
Crop circles, yes. But anyway, you know, we wound up finding the job of, you know, I don't know how many bales were we feeding, you know, a couple hundred ewes, quite a few. Anyway, it was a big task to try to get rid of it. So we just left it. And what was interesting is by August, there would, initially this was not true. This took a few years for this to become true. But eventually by August, there'd be 2 to 3 times more grass growing where that bale sat than there was in the surrounding area. Now, I said it didn't happen the first year. If you're starting with really poor soils that have very low biological activity, it is going to sit there. But let it, just let it. Don't stress about that. Give it time. Eventually, as your organic matter increases and the biological activity of your soil improves, it will break down a lot faster. So now, kind of my test of, you know, how well are we doing is sheep manure should disappear very rapidly from a paddock. You should not be able to go out there and find the berries. Now, I realize you're in a much drier climate, but here where it's wetter, the biological activity in that soil should break down that sheep manure really quick. And when I say biological activity, that includes the insects and everything. You know, it's the microbes, the fungi, the insects. But my point is that when I leave a paddock and come back in a couple of weeks, I can't find the sheep manure anymore. Mm-hmm. The same is true of these piles of hay. That hay disappears faster and faster each successive year here. And I still measure 2 to 3 times more grass. Now the whole pasture is growing probably about a total of 2.5 times more grass than we used to. But the site where a bale sat that previous year is always 2 to 3 times more than the surrounding area.
Wow.
So that just shows you the fertilizer value. And another interesting thing about this bale feeding is that the hay insulates the contents of that residue. And the contents are a whole lot of urine and manure packed in there. And when it melts in the spring, what I noticed was that our water running off our fields, what little runs off, is clear. It is not yellow or looking like it's laden with manure. It's clear. And we also know that the water is sampled just downstream from us for there's a river and lake system that, and there's a water association, and they test the water to look for contaminants. Mm-hmm. And they've never picked up on our sheep in that water samples. They do get a lot of wild geese in their samples, but they do not get sheep.
They need to get those geese to practice regenerative grazing.
That's right. They got to get them out of the water. But anyway, so I found that interesting. And so I started paying a little closer attention to it. And what I noticed in March and April, when we're melting, is that the contents of a circle of hay where a bale sat is still frozen, hard, while the soil around it is thawing out. And by the time that residue thaws, it's right now, I can go out there and scrape through the residue and still find ice. By the time that pile finally thaws out, it soaks right into the ground because all the surrounding area is already thawed out and it's not just running off. So that, I found that rather interesting. And there is a guy, and I don't know how to say his name. His first name is Paul and his last name starts with a J. It's a very long name with a lot of vowels in there. Not sure I can say his name, but anyway, Paul was working at a university in Alberta, and he was studying different manure management strategies. And what he found out was that, shockingly, when you compost manure, when you scrape a lot, which is very traditional around here, people keep their animals in a yard, and in the spring, they scrape that all up and compost it, and then they spread it back out on the field, that only 5% of the nutrients are retained in that compost, which just totally surprised me. Hmm. But he pointed out that, you know, when you scrape that stuff up, you smell it, right? You can smell that. Yep. Smell is your nutrients volatizing into the atmosphere. It's also greenhouse gas, by the way.
You're right.
But it is your nutrients in that manure is going up into the air. That's what that smell is. And so possibly part of the magic of what we're doing here is we do not disturb those piles. We leave them alone. And so we're not disturbing them. So we're not volatilizing the nutrients that are stored inside that pile of hay. The other thing that he found out, and I do not have those figures right in front of me, but that the potassium and phosphorus and nitrogen were in the 20% range, like up to 27%, something like 23 to 27% of the nutrients were retained in the soil under that pile of hay.
Wow.
Compared to 5% if you composted it and then spread it. So that's why these circles turn so green by late August, is because there's a tremendous amount of nutrition in there. The other thing that it does over time is that I've done some perk tests. Mm-hmm. Where I was using a coffee can, and you cut the old fashioned coffee can, the metal ones,
right.
3-pound coffee can, and you cut each end out, you pound it into the ground. So it's about halfway into the ground. It's difficult in a drought, by the way, the soil does get a little hard and you're going to destroy your can. So, but anyway, you pound it halfway in and you put, I would have to check on this. I'm sorry, I didn't come prepared with this one, but I think it's 454 milliliters of water.
Right. It's an inch. Yeah.
So it makes an inch of water, and you put a piece of plastic wrap in the can. So you pour the water onto the plastic wrap, and then you pull the plastic wrap out and let it soak in, and you time it and watch how long it soaks in. And I had done this. There's a place I rent across the street here, and I had been on that field for 20 years. And my neighbor across the fence, it's the same piece of geology. Keep in mind, it's the same clay that we have. Neighbor across the fence had continuously grazed his pasture. And it's a very typical cow pasture around here where it's, I say, grazed to within an inch of its life. you know, he would keep it very short.
It looks like a lawn.
Yeah, it looks like a lawn. Anyway, I did this perk test on his side of the fence, and then I walked 30 feet from the fence on my side, and I did the perk test on my side. And I also did the perk test where I knew a bale of hay. You know, you can see the rings because they're maybe a different species of grass growing, or it's greener or it's thicker. But I would go where a bale had sat, and I did it there. And the water would go into what, first of all, let's start on his side of the fence, continuously grazed. The water did not move in 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. It just sat there. It did not soak in at all. And in on my side of the fence, in a place where it in 15 minutes time, I think about a quarter inch to a little more than that had soaked in. And then on the place where a bale had sat, it soaked in instantly.
Right.
You know, like you couldn't even measure it. It was like, it was gone.
Yep.
So I dug some soil samples.
Oh, good.
You know, I was really curious what's going on here. So on his side of the fence, there was a compacted layer where the water could not penetrate beyond that compacted layer. And it actually fell apart. It broke apart at that compaction layer. Mm-hmm. Okay. And the roots of those plants, as expected, were only about a half an inch long.
Right.
There was no root system on his side of the fence. On my side of the fence, we had a lot more root system. It reached down. Let's see, I'm using an 18-inch spade to dig a post-hole spade. Mm-hmm. So my samples were 18 inches deep. And on my side of the fence, where a bale has not sat, we saw roots for, I don't know, I'd say almost a foot down. But of course, you know, we allow the grass to get at least a foot or 2 or 3 feet tall on the top side. And they always say, what you have on the top, you're going to have below. So we had a lot deeper roots. And I thought, well, that explains it. You know, this is before I did those perk tests. That must explain it. We have more deeper roots, and that's why we have more grass over here. Well, then I dug into the place where a bale had sat sometime in the past. I don't know how long ago. It could have been 4 years ago or so. I was trying to decipher by the color of the twine that I dug up how long ago that was. But the roots went the full depth of the spade. So that's 18 inches of root depth. So quite a dramatic difference from the continuously grazed side to the bale grazing and rotational grazing that I was doing.
Right.
A huge difference. Right. Well, this was in 2006, by the way, that I was doing all this testing. And the reason I was doing it was because we experienced that year what was called a 100-year drought. It's the driest it's been in 100 years. And what prompted examining this was in September, we got a 4-inch rainfall. And in 10 days, I kid you not, we had 10 inches of grass on our side of the fence. 10 inches. You could almost sit there and listen to it grow. It was growing so fast. Mm-hmm. And it was beautiful, green, vegetative, thick grass. And on his side of the fence, it turned green, but it was still a half an inch tall. You know, it did not get taller at all. And in fact, that guy sold his cattle about 3 years later, because, you know, if you hurt a pasture during a drought, it's not going to recover the next year. It's going to take years to recover. And he found himself having to feed hay by July every year after that. Even though we turned back to normal rainfall, he was still feeding hay by late summer. So he sold the cattle. It didn't pay, you know, to be feeding hay in the summertime. So, and of course, he asked to rent the field that I had so much grass in. He went to the landowner and asked to rent it because he thought it was somehow a better field than his, but never thought to ask, you know, gee, what are you doing that you have too much grass? But anyway, the regrowth after that 4-inch rainfall was phenomenal. And that's why I was looking at, gee, you know, is it because we have deeper roots? Is it because we have better penetration of the water? And I would say it's both, you know, right. That the water probably just ran off of his side. And on my side, it was soaking in at different rates, depending upon whether a bale sat there or not previously, but it was soaking in on my side. And then the other thing is that my plants had deeper roots because they get a chance to rest during the grazing season and put those roots down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, we've seen really similar stuff in a much different environment here. Some friends of mine have been doing bale grazing for a few years, and last year was record horrible drought in Montana. And so we went out in August with a penetrometer, which is about a 3-foot long rod with a sharp point with a handle, and it has a gauge on it where you can look at the pounds pressure exerted. And so the idea is you push that into the ground using no more than 200 pounds per inch, no more than 200 PSI, and see how deep it'll go. And we were in their hay meadows. And so we're in the hay meadows away from where they had done bale grazing, and we could get it in the ground maybe an inch and a half at the most. And then we went to where they had bale grazed, and we almost fell over because we pushed on it and it just sunk into the ground right up to the hilt so fast that literally, I mean, it's not like you on your snowshoes with the sheep, but, you know, just almost face plant. And it changes the rate, just like you were saying, Janet, about it melts slower, it warms up slower, it also dries out slower. And right. I think it's just totally changed things. And I was so impressed with what the penetrometer did there. I went over to a stack of hay that just got left here at my place. It was about maybe a foot and a half to 2 feet tall at the very most in 2019, in the summer of 2019, it was big like that. And so I went out in the fall of 2021 with my penetrometer the same day. Well, I guess it was a little later because it was like November, so it wasn't August, but I couldn't get it in the ground. Even the little tip is an inch tall, and I couldn't get even the whole tip into the ground away from the bale grazing. And the same thing happened. I put it where that stack of hay was and I buried it.
Yeah.
It is phenomenal what it does. And so there's the nutrient cycling piece of it. There's the softening of the moisture cycles. You know, it's just building the soil biology. And you've done that with every stage of your grazing program. And you know, what's interesting to me is that it sounds like you've done it just by good observation and good sense. I think I'll try this next and see what happens. And I had written down, Janet, a list of all these questions I was going to ask you, but you've done such a wonderful job in answering them. Going back to what I said in the beginning about regenerative grazing is like juggling 6 balls into the air. What I think I've heard from you is that it's improved the performance of your animals, especially since they're not getting eaten now as much, you know, because you can keep them together. The health of your plants, the biodiversity in your pastures, maybe that's one thing we haven't touched on. We'll come back to that. The health of your soils, a clear win. The way that you're spending your time, a clear win. It has to be positive for your bank balance. But what about the question of biodiversity in your pastures? Do you think that it has changed over time with this? Are you seeing more different species?
We were more like bluegrass dominant during our 90 style grazing because bluegrass can tolerate that kind of grazing. And of course, when you're grazing really vegetative grass, it's easy for the sheep to graze it all the way down to, like I say, an inch of its life. So bluegrass tolerates that. And so our pastures were more dominated by bluegrass and white clover. And those are just two species that tolerate close grazing. And it's not that we weren't giving it a rest. It's just that we weren't giving it nearly as long a rest. Now we see, can't name them all right off the top of my head, but there's over 8 types of grasses out there, including some warm season grasses and cool season grasses. And it changes through the year, by the way. What we see in the spring isn't what we see in the middle of the summer, and it changes again in the fall. So to come here once, you just get a snapshot of all the different species that are out there. And there's probably 5 different legumes out there. So yeah, at least eight grasses and 5 different legumes.
Wow, it sounds like a win on every one of the ways that I would evaluate success in grazing. I wonder, Janet, as we close our podcast today, what advice do you have for us as we're trying to think about having the type of success that you've had with grazing?
The best advice I have is go visit somebody who's doing it, and visit them not just once, but visit them throughout the season so that you can see the progression that goes on and how they deal with the different challenges at each time of year. That is the very best thing you can do, is travel, get out there, go visit other producers. I don't think you can learn this any better than to actually see it being done.
Wow. This has been such a learning opportunity, Janet. I can't thank you enough for sharing what you've learned from years of trials and hardship, and the story of overcoming all that is very inspiring. So thank you again for talking with us.
You're most welcome.
That's it for this episode. Thanks for listening. Additional information about this episode and related resources can be found at atra.incat.org. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe to Voices from the Field wherever you get your podcasts. I'm your host, Rich Myers. ATRA, Voices from the Field, is produced by the National Center for Appropriate Technology, headquartered in Butte, Montana. It's supported by the USDA Rural Business Cooperative Service as part of NCAT's ATRA Sustainable Agriculture Program. Any opinions, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this recording are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of the USDA or NCAT. We'll catch you again next week, and until then, keep on farming.